And well, Intech apparently is working well. So as I was saying before, the comment that you made in the forum, one of the students made a comment about Mary Rowlandson's view of the Native Americans of the for this purpose we're going to call them Indians, despite this term being derogatory in if we used it nowadays. So I'm only going to use it for the purposes of this class. The way that she views Indians at the beginning and at the end, there is a point that Veronica strikes very well. It's a way of dehumanizing them. But one of the things that is interesting is the way that they are dehumanized at the beginning of the story. Absolutely, they are compared with devilish creatures. And Veronica made a statement that it was a form of racism. I wouldn't say it's a form of racism. I would say it's a mechanism to dehumanize. When you dehumanize an opponent, it's easier to have absolutely no respect or no interest in their well-being and in their salvation and even in their lives. So dehumanizing is something that we're going to see as a very common thing for Western civilizations. They're not only going to do it with the Indians in America, they're going to do it with the Indians in India, they're going to do it with the Africans, of course. If you've read something that is 2 centuries older in Heart of Darkness, if you've read Heart of Darkness, I think you have last year maybe, you've come to the conclusion that dehumanizing was a highly used European mechanism to justify things that were unjustifiable. And from that point of view, this narrative is from the opposite direction, from the opposite point of view, from the point of view of a victim, but the victim that is that doesn't take any type of consideration or grants any type of humanity to the other side, to the Indians. Very interesting how this point of view changes throughout the narrative, how there is an arc of change throughout the story. Okay, and that's very interesting because we normally don't get to see an evolution of the narrator. The narrative voice is the same voice of the, it's a first person narrative, and this sort of narrative does not normally evolve the way that she refers to the same collective at the beginning towards the end. That's really interesting. What we have here in this quote that I always take from each of the authors is the depiction of the Indians at the beginning of the story, and how they had been so cruel to her family and beloved the people of her that surrounded her life. It is a solemn sight to see so many Christians lying in their blood, some here and some there, like a company of sheep torn by wolves. So the sheep, we can see the lambs, which is very biblical, are the Puritans, and the wolves, which always have like this satanic twist to them, would be the Indians. All of them stripped naked by a company of hellhounds. And there's a satanic reference. Roaring, singing, chanting, and insulting, as if they would have torn our very hearts out. Yet the Lord, by his almighty power, and look at this capitalization here, which is really interesting, preserved a number of us from death. And there were 24 of us taken alive and carried captive. This is a turning point. This is when a nightmare turns into the beginning of a new nightmare, of being what the narrative calls removed from place to place to place throughout the story. So how do we put captivity narrative within the global frame of the course? Well, captivity narrative serves a very distinct purpose. If the environment wants to change to the board, I'll explain that. If not, I'll just talk about it. The captivity narrative serves a purpose of being the first distinct American genre. Okay, so we can say that from the point of view of importance, from the literary point of view, it's the first distinctly American genre. From the point of view of Mary Rowlandson, it is the first work of prose, and referring to prose, a long narrative, written by a woman in America. So it has a key importance. It has the power, the potence of being a first-person narrative, and being at the same time, it sounds very honest. It sounds very raw. And it sounds, at the same time, with this dark mentality that we have as a people, it sounds appealing. It sounds appealing as a genre to read. This is an adventure story. So for the American public, it's a cautionary tale. This is what can happen to you if you're not careful, if you don't garrison enough your fort, your city, your town. Be careful. These people come without a previous warning. We're going to see the bigger context of why Indians were attacking settlers, why this was happening. It was not as simplistic as Indians are evil and they like to kill Christians. It's of course, it's not as simplistic as that. We can look for the reasons if we dig just if we scratch a bit on the surface. From the point of view of an international reader, remember that everything that was written in America, if it was relevant, had an echo in the rest of the world. This was an American genre. It had nothing to copy from England, so it was the first thing to feel proud about because it was uniquely American. So for the international audience, for the international readership, it was a very interesting read because it was full of the violence that everybody unadmittingly enjoys. It has the direct emotion of real events. It's very fast paced, so it's like the modern thriller for the time. It was the equivalent of the modern thriller. From the perspective of the time, this type of narrative, it's called captivity narrative. Key word to take and carry away, captivity narrative. It's going to become a very popular genre because it is a trailblazer. A trailblazer is something that pioneers something. Sorry for the handwriting. I don't write as a four-year-old. It's just that this computer is not responding very well. It's a trailblazer of what can be of what is later going to be called frontier literature. Frontier literature is any literature that has to do with the unexplored, with the mysterious. This is going to become a very interesting topic for example, for the European Romantics. But in America, it's going to be real life. It's going to be the instigator of all the Westerns, all of the narrative that talk about the unexplored West, the travel books, etc. In the Romantic, post-Romantic, modernist era, or in the realist era, it's going to be, for example, what's taking place in Africa. Heart of Darkness is frontier literature because the frontier is everything that is unexplored to men. This frontier idea, we talked about it as being one of the key elements that composes the American dream, and also this idea of the manifest destiny that Puritans bring to America. Is going to be at the same time attractive, but it's going to be a warning signal, a way of learning from the perils that living in a frontier territory has. it's going to be so appealing that 2 centuries later, and we're going to talk about, well, maybe 1.5 centuries later, we're going to talk about this author. James Fenimore Cooper is going to write about another author, is going to write about this in a fictional tone. And his fiction is going to be so realistic for the time that it's going to transcend and reach our times. And for example, one of his most popular readings, The Last of the Mohicans, was turned into a film. We're going to talk about The Last of the Mohicans in the second semester. It's part of a saga. And that helps us understand how important this genre was for American literature, because it was the beginning of everything to come. It was the beginning of looking for that distinct American tradition, American culture, American topics. Something that wasn't a copy of what was happening in the countryside of York or in the slums of London. It was a way of looking for something that sounded fresh all around the globe. Well, this frontier literature, this captivity narrative, is going to be well accepted by Puritans. Why? Because it gives the tone that Puritans want to have. They want to have a tone when they represent themselves of suffering, of not having it easy in life, of enduring difficulties, of overcoming difficulties through their faith in God. So there is going to be a resemblance, there's going to be a mirroring, a parallel between this type of captivity narrative that we see here and, for example, biblical passages of Jonah and the belly of the whale, or other type of passages that relate us to being abandoned, being trapped, being stripped of freedom, being tested in the eyes of God, and overcoming this test. Because captivity narrative is about how ultimately faith carried them to a final success, a costly success in this case. You will for sure walk away with that impression. Very costly for Mary Rowlandson's life. Mary Rowlandson lost one of her children during the kidnapping. She had to endure having two of her children kidnapped and separated from her in different parts of the of how they were held hostage, and. This will change our perspective of what it was to kidnap and carry someone away. We'll see that it's very different to the kind of imprisonment that we would expect. Mary Rowlandson is taken away with the Indians, and she has to live her life among the Indians. She is not tied to a tree. She is not set up in a prison. She's just left there to live with them until a ransom can be negotiated, and she can be ultimately liberated. When we talk about the objectives of the unit, we want, of course, to walk away with those ideas of what a captivity narrative is all about, and how this is the forefront of all the American genres that will follow. We want to want to look for those parallelisms between the European settlers' depictions of the indigenous people of America, and how an idea that we've already started to shape with John Smith's description of the savage, sometimes kind, barbarian, with William Bradford's image of the unreliable Indian, with Mary Rowlandson's shifting image of first a devilish Indian towards an Indian that she comes to understand to a certain extent. We're going to see how later on in the story, Mary Rowlandson starts to use words that belong to Indian language, and she feels in a certain way integrated and even befriended, or at least endeared to a certain extent, with some of the members that are holding her captive. So So we can see how that surprising transformation in her psychological acceptance of her situation is something that is fascinating and that sets this narrative apart from all the rest of the captivity narratives. How were these captivity narratives normally written? They were written with the help, arduous help normally, of priests, pastors, clergymen, whatever, that were normally the people that knew how to write and read. So many of these captivity narratives, and that's what makes Mary Rowlandson's different, that it's written by her, and it follows her own chain of thoughts, were reinterpreted by a priest or by a pastor to match the ideals of the Puritan didactic style, to serve the purposes that Puritans wanted to serve, and to and maybe to refrain from extending in certain points and extend artificially on other points when that was convenient. So we're going to examine, this is the first long text that we have that is not mainly descriptive, where we're going to be able to analyze the four narrative modes. The four narrative modes, this is probably one of the key concepts that you have to walk away when you finish English studies, is that every literary work is a combination of the choice that the author makes to use these four narrative modes: description, report, speech, and comment. There is nothing more. Those are the way that all narratives are written. Depending on whether one type of mode is more present or not, we can understand a lot about the author's intention or about the author's style. Many times the style is obvious, only reading the way that the author uses one way or another. If you have a favorite author and you've read several books by the same author, you may have come to recognize that there's a certain pattern in the way that author writes and how that author balances with these four narrative modes. Some of them elude entering into comment. Some rely heavily on comment. Others use description in a balanced way with speech. Others use report with speech. Others use a combination of all the four styles. And that's what I think you're going to find an interesting exercise in the weeks to come, to compare the style of the writings that you come upon and compare that different use of description, report, speech, and comment. It's not going to be the last time that we talk about this. We're going to see that this is a perfect example of the Puritan plain style prose, and we're going to discover how all of these all the subtext below aligns with the idea of how the subtext is aligned or not with what we read. So we're going to try to read in between lines and see different different intentions in the writer at the same time as we're reading one thing, if we're able to come to different conclusions. We're going to, I would love for you to be able at the end of this class to connect the four 17th century writers. Now that we finish early American literature, we're going to start in a different type of literature in the next unit. We're going to enter the age of Enlightenment and the period of the Great Awakening, and we're going to see how this first generation has dealt with Puritanism, with religion, with arriving to a new hostile territory, and compare it with how the next and the successive generations do the same, if they're able to cope with their faith as much as the initial generations, I can anticipate as a spoiler that they're not able to do that. They're not able to maintain such a sustained and hardcore faith. And this author wraps up our idea of the early Puritan settlements and settlers. Talking about Mary Rowlandson, she was born in 1637 in an English town. So again, we have one of these cases where we have an immigrant arriving to America in search of what they were all searching for: religious freedom. She arrived with her 9 siblings. That can give you a tone of the type of families that we have. Highly religious families that relied on creating big, close-knitted families in small, close-knitted communities. So it's a combination of big families in very compact communities. Where did she reside? In a town that is probably famous for cultural reasons for you more than for literary reasons, even though everything that you probably know Salem for is literary in the end. You've probably heard about the Salem witch trials. A group of women were burnt to death in Salem. This really happened, and it happened in the following generation of Mary Rowlandson's lifetime, accused of witchcraft. And that goes to show how powerful religion was, that it could lead you to death if you did not follow the strict conventions of the time, and how fanatic this religion was, and how intolerant with other ways of perceiving the world the religion was. One of the key authors that we're going to cover in this course and in the second semester, Nathaniel Hawthorne, is directly related. His grandfather was one of the judges that was the judge of the Salem witchcraft trials. And what we're going to see in future generations, what stays instead of Puritanism, is a sense of guilt. This is just an idea that you can pick up later in the second semester, but where now we have a fervor and religious devotion, in the future we're going to have guilt for all the past sins, not only their own sins, but the sins of the previous generations, and the sense of fanatism that many of the people of the late 18th century and early 19th century are able to perceive in the previous generations of American inhabitants. Her father was one of the founders of the town, where a fierce episode of King Philip's War took place. Lancaster. What is King Philip's War? King Philip's War is an Indian war fought between Indian tribes, but provoked by Westerners, of course, because as more more English arrived through the East, as more French arrived through the South and through what is beyond the Appalachian Mountains to America, there was an enormous displacement, enormous forced migrations of Indian tribes that had to raise camp of places where they had lived for hundreds of years, or maybe throughout their entire existence, and they had to look for new territory, new sources of food, new ways of enduring as a tribe. That created a huge clashes between the Indians. Many of these Indians were resented that they had been expelled from their territory. And in that sentiment of resentment, there was an attempt to recover territory, which of course failed because it's probably not a good idea to fight with arrows against the people that are holding guns, and the balance was not sufficient. Until her capture in 1676, Mary Rowlandson led a normal life. She had four children, one of whom died in infancy. Most of the 30 members of her household, all of the family living in a single house, were slaughtered, were killed in a terrible way on that February the 10th. 8 family members, including herself, were kidnapped, were abducted. Her 6-year-old daughter was fatally wounded by a bullet during the ransack, and Mary Rowlandson carried her, dying and sick, until she finally passed away. She was held hostage with her 2 surviving children, although she was separated and was only allowed brief visits during her 82-day captivity. Her resiliency and survival skills surprised everyone, including herself. I think that when you start to read the captivity narrative, you can't imagine it running for so long, because she seems that she's embracing death, or she wishes for death. And that's an important point, because Puritans cannot want death. It's against the tenets of Puritanism to accept suicide or embracing death as a way of ending your life. It was God's will to give you life, and it was God's will to take away your life. There is no free will. Everything is predestined, and therefore, to be a true Puritan, you have to endure whatever sacrifice God has asked you to endure, because it's a test of God. So that the idea that she would just let herself go was simply unacceptable for a truly Puritan woman. She was released for a £20 ransom on May the 2nd, 1676, and her children were also ransomed and liberated that same summer. One of the motivations to write her narrative was as a way of helping her children understand and take a valuable lesson of life, of everything that happened. So it follows 100% the didactic purpose of Puritans. You will notice by the writing, because it's very easy to understand, how it also follows a Puritan playing style. So it's a 100% Puritan narrative. If, on top of that, Mary Rowlandson is talented enough to make it sound with the same biblical tone as many passages, and it's reminiscent of biblical passages, it is an absolute success for Puritans, and it is appealing for Puritans and non-Puritans here and there. We're going to talk about the King Philip's War now that I brought it up. The King Philip's War is also called the First Indian War. It's a conflict between the colonists and the Native American Indians, and it had a especially violent period between 1675 and 1676. Remember that the removal, the abduction, takes place in 1676. The conflict took the lives of 600 colonists and 3,000 Native Americans. Believe me that the toll was much higher for the Native Americans, because all of them were warriors, whereas many of the colonists were defenseless women, children, and of course men. So the toll on the Native Americans was enormous, and it was one of the reasons why many of those tribes began to decline severely. The war is named for King Philip, one of the son of the Massasoit tribe, and chief of the Wampanoag. If you remember the Wampanoag, the Wampanoags are the same Indians that interacted with William Bradford, and they're part of the same group of tribes that interacted with John Smith. So they belong to the tribes that were interacting with all the authors that we've seen so far. His native name was Metacom, Metacomet, or Pometacom. Metacomet had adopted the English name of King Philip in honor of the previously friendly relations between his father and the original Mayflower Pilgrims, who signed a peace agreement. Remember the Thanksgiving, the initial peace agreement with William Bradford. King Philip's War was a sorry attempt to recover lost land and lost predominance that they would never recover again, and try to remove families like Mary Rowlandson's family from what they considered their sacred lands or sacred territories. Mary Rowlandson's account provide good hints of the reasons for the conflicts, because those Indians had been removed from that same territory where she was, and they were starving, and they were seeing their own people die. So part of this war has a lot to do with revenge, with taking revenge on the strife that those Indians were enduring in their own skin and in their own lives. This war was the single greatest calamity to occur in the 17th century Puritan New England, and is considered to be the deadliest war in the history of European settlement in North America, in proportion to the populations that existed at the time. When we talk about captivity narratives, we're going to talk about female captivity narratives to an extent, even though the one I was talking about, The Last of the Mohicans, is not framed as a female captivity. Remember that that's fiction, and this is fact. The narrative has become one of the staples of frontier literature, one of the main works of frontier literature. Its popularity has endured the lifetime of Mary Rowlandson and reached almost 200 years later, 150 years later, to the early Romantic period, where James Fenimore Cooper rethought, reimagined the life of the frontier settlements and the life of the Indians, and how they lived in constant opposition between European superpowers fighting and Indians in the middle, allying and betraying one party or the other. Despite Fenimore Cooper's account being very attractive from the literary point of view, it is far from accurate, because Fenimore Cooper never had any direct interaction with the reality of the area, and therefore it's the contribution that James Fenimore Cooper has had for female captivity narratives has been a bit too watered down the realism that we can perceive in this one. Mary Rowlandson's work is the best example of literature. I already gave the reasons. She was educated enough. She talked in the first person. She's rich in the small details of everyday life. And she had her own story that she wanted to tell. She was not influenced by anyone to stress one factor or remove any set of details. She was pushed to write this captivity narrative because her family members and her community believed that it could be a very good lesson for the community. And so she was not in pursuit of reputation or acknowledgement or anything of the kind. Well, I can't recall any, if there are, think of the idea of being held captive. is normally not considered to be very masculine. And if you take it back to John Smith captivity that we do know about, he gave all types of excuses to say, I was held captive and I didn't die fighting for my life because I wanted a bigger reward or because I was spying and I was trying to. So I would say that female captivity narratives were well seen by the society. A masculine or a male captivity narrative would not be well seen by peers for those reasons. Puritan reasons of the role of men and the role of women and maybe the testosterone involved in being held captive or not. There are other relevant writers. This doesn't come in the book, I think, but you might find it interesting in case you want to dive a little deeper in the topic. And the captivity narrative, every detail that is gorish or too raw, too crude, is used as a vehicle to portray the horror that the Indians inflicted on the Puritans and that the Puritans had to endure. So there is a spiritual purpose and a spiritual driving force to everything that is said in that narrative. I'm going to briefly talk about Mary Rowlandson's narrative in particular, and then we're going to read from it. Before I get there, let me read from my favorite handbook, From Puritanism to Postmodernism, a couple of paragraphs that talks about Mary Rowlandson's work and why it is definitely a work that is interesting and necessary to know. The spirit of Mrs. Mary Rowlandson, this is on page 27 of The Puritan Legacy, which I think is the second chapter of the book. The spirit of Mary Rowlandson's story, the sovereignty and goodness of God together with the faithfulness of his promises displayed, being a narrative of the captivity and restoration of Mrs. Mary Rowlandson. That's the title of the book. 1682. It was well and carefully written. It was an account of her actual captivity during King Philip's War. It became a prototype, immensely popular, frequently reprinted, much copied. Rowlandson's tale is an adventure story which, as the title suggests, never forgets the experience's transcendental meaning. The Puritan mythos guides her. She links her imprisonment with that of the soul snared by sin and with the countless captivities of the Bible from the children of Israel to Jonah in the whale's belly. So when she's held captive, she doesn't blame the Indians. That wouldn't be very Puritan. She blames herself. I haven't been, we as a family, we as a community, haven't been Puritan enough for God to prevent us from this happening. Everything that happens is because we failed during our path here. And it is my job to take repentance, to understand my mistakes, and to go back to the light and out of this darkness that I have pushed myself into. But even though the Indians are secondary actors that are taken as a hellish complication, the fault, the guilt, rests on their own shoulders. Okay, so there is a truly biblical allusion to that. Her language echoes that of the Old Testament, and she draws on its types. When she calls the Indians hellhounds, and their dancing a resemblance of hell, she means what she says. The Indians are servants of Satan, their celebrations an emblem of spiritual death. Her frequent forced marches parallel the hazardous, devil-beset journey all must make through life. Her rescue, the same unaccountable act of God's mercy that will bring his chosen people, in capital letters, to the heavenly kingdom. So her salvation
is a resemblance of the future salvation of all of her people. The essential Puritan myth asserts itself. The captivity narrative is sermon. It's a moral lesson. It's a revelatory history. But also, it's a precursor of later sensationalist fiction and Gothic tale. What I've talked about in Heart of Darkness, in the Gothic Gothic tales of romantic times, set in an exotic place. Well, it is a forefront of everything that is going to come afterwards in terms of fiction. But for her people, it is a purely mystical message that is sent by God, and that they have to interpret in the light of guilt and sin, and in the light of repentance and repair of the lost faith of God in them, as the endurance of everything that the chosen people have to endure in the Bible. This is a trial for her, and these are her tribulations. Mary Rowlandson's narrative begins in 1677. Or 1678. I think that in another part of the slides, I've written 1676. I would have to check on those. When she wrote her narrative, yeah, this makes sense. 1678, 1 or 2 years later, after her captivity, which took place in 1676, as I said before. The work was written in Puritan plain style, with a didactic purpose. And its original name, I've read it before, is The Sovereignty and Goodness of God, and much more. It was originally published in 1682. The book was an instant success. It produced 3 editions in Massachusetts and 1 more in London in the first year. I don't know if you have an understanding of how books were published in the 17th century. For a book to be published, somebody told you the idea of the book. It's like the inlet of the book. Somebody told you what the book was going to be about. You paid for the book in full. And when they collected enough money to print the edition, they would go print the edition. And several months later, you would get your copy of the book. So every book that was printed had an owner before it was printed, because it was very expensive. Nobody had the money to front for 100 books, 1,000 books. Imagine 3 editions in Massachusetts, 1 edition more in London during the first year. So that just goes to show how appealing the story was immediately. That's a testament of the success. The London edition of the book set the popular name that has reached our days, and that is normally a subtitle of the original one. A narrative of the captivity and restoration of Mrs. Mary Rowlandson. The book, instead of being divided into chapters, is divided into every time she's moved from one place to another, into removals. So the name of each chapter, and you can see that in the book, are the removals. We're going to read 4 passages from 4 different removals. The tone is indebted to the American Jeremiad. Everything that we've talked about, this Puritan style, is what we can talk about as a Jeremiad. The Jeremiad is a style that talks about the misfortunes of the Israelites. Because they have abandoned their faith, they have been bad, in the case of the Israelites, bad Jews, in the case of the Puritans, bad Puritans. And because of their failure to remain faithful to God, to maintain that covenant, that agreement, it calls for repentance so they can restore the covenant and live happily. Happiness depends on how little they sin. So their only mission in life is to not mess it up. If you want to place it in a certain simplistic and sad manner. Her work would unintentionally turn her into the first lengthy piece of prose written by women in the New England of the time. Rowlandson is currently celebrated as one of the great female authors and one of the pioneers of American autobiography. the purpose of writing this was for her surviving children, but the book has maintained an enduring success. And when you read it, I think you're going to understand why. It has a quality to it, a tone. Oh my God, what did I do? I opened the survey. It has a tone that is easy to read, and it's fast paced. So it's a book that you can read in an evening or an evening or two. The first removal that we're going to read. Any questions so far? No? Yeah. Well, it's plain. Plain is that it's lacking any decor. It's to the point, and God is in the center of it. It's written with the purpose of serving the teachings of the Old Testament and remaining faithful to God. The Old and New Testament and remaining faithful to God. The Puritan plain style is more what it lacks than what it has. It lacks any type of metaphor, artificial elements to embellish it or to make it more beautiful. And it ties into the didactic purpose. It has to be easy to understand, and it has to talk to the people in the same way that the Bible speaks to them when they read the Bible. Bible reading is a main activity. That's a main pastime for people, reading the Bible, as sad as that may sound. So these stories tie into those activities that people can engage in and are well seen because they follow the Puritan tenets. Exactly. No fiction. In fact, the Puritans called fiction a sophisticated way of lying. So everything that has to do with fiction has no place in the minds of Puritans. So what are we going to see one century later? Pure fiction. Because it's a reaction to the loss of faith of future generations in Puritanism. And there's the opposite reaction. If the first six or seven authors that we study are going to be purely about real accounts, real events. The next six or seven are going to be about accounts that are fictionalized because there is a reaction of what came before, which is very common in literature, to react and to rebel against the previous status quo. The first removal... The book says, we will read the initial paragraphs of Rawlinson's captivity narrative, followed by several brief extracts from only seven removes. A term she used to refer to the stages of her forced march. Our selection include her vivid account of the brutal assault on Lancaster, some comments about the painful conditions of the beginning of the author's captivity, in the wilderness, the pathetic report of little Sarah's death from wounds 1 week later, followed by some glimpses of the gradual transformation Rawlinson underwent as she tried to adapt to life among the Narragansetts. The final extract from her 20th remove is a concluding remark of her work. Okay? So, as you can see, there's going to be more comment maybe in the 20th removal than description. From a narrative of the captivity and restoration of Mrs. Mary Rawlinson. On the 10th of February 1675 came the Indian with great numbers upon Lancaster. Their first coming was about sunrising. Hearing the noise of sun guns, we looked out, several houses were burning, and the smoke ascending to heaven. As you can see, everything is to the point, and if anything is beyond the easiest description possible, it's because it makes a reference to God. So it ends a sentence, and the smoke ascending not to the sky, but to heaven. Okay? There were five persons taken in one house.
The father and the mother and a second child. Oh, sorry, page 66. The father and the child. Let me see. I got lost. And the second child. They knocked on the head. The other two they took and carried away alive. There were two others who, being out of their garrison upon some occasion, were set upon. One was knocked on the head, the other escaped. Another there was who, running along, was shot and wounded and fell down. He begged of them his life, promising them money, as they told me, but they would not hearken to him, but knocked him in the head and stripped him naked and split open his bowels. If you think about how explicit she is about this, the death of this person, there's something previous that he begs for his life and offers money and gets executed and his bowels are open. So I wouldn't say it's far-fetched to think that she finds it questionable for a Puritan to beg for his life and beg for mercy, and offer money in exchange for mercy, and everything that happens to him is a consequence of what he's done before. So that is a very clear Puritan idea of act consequence. Okay. Another, seeing many of the Indians about his barn, ventured and went out, but was quickly shot down. There were three others belonging to the same garrison who were killed. The Indians, getting up upon the roof of the barn, had advantage to shoot down upon them over their fortification. Thus, these murderous wretches went on burning and destroying before them. As you can see, one of the things that Indians traded for with the settlers, both with the French, with the English, and to a certain point with the Dutch or with the Spanish that were in the area, was for gunpowder and guns, which made them more dangerous. So it was not uncommon for tribes to create alliances with some of the powers, for some tribes to be subscribed to the French, other tribes being subscribed to the English through these trading agreements where they would yield crop or other elements that were necessary, furs, for example, to make clothes, and in exchange, they would give them guns and gunpowder. Definitely not a good idea. At length, they came and beset our own house, and quickly, it was the dolefulest day that ever mine eyes saw. The house stood upon the edge of a hill. Some of the Indians got behind the hill, others into the barn, and others behind anything that could shelter them, from which place they shot against the house, so that the bullets seemed to fly like hail, and quickly they wounded one man among us, then another, and then a third. About 2 hours, according to my observation, in that amazing time, about the house before they prevailed to fire it. Some in our house were fighting for their lives, others wallowing in their blood, the house on fire over our heads, and the bloody heathen, again, another devilish term, ready to knock us on the head if we stirred out. Now might we hear mothers and children crying out for themselves and one another, "Lord, what shall we do?" Then I took my children and one of my sisters hers to go forth and leave the house. But as soon as we came to the door and appeared, the Indians shot so thick that the bullets rattled against the house, as if one had taken a handful of stones and threw them, so that we were fain to give back. We had six stout dogs belonging to our garrison, but none of them would stir. Though another time, if any Indian had come to the door, they were ready to fly upon him and tear him down. So as you can see, she sees divine action or hellish satanic action in the way the dogs behave and why, if they've been very brave before, they were being such cowards now. The Lord hereby would make us the more acknowledge His hand and to see that our help is always in Him. But out we must go, the fire increasing and coming along behind us, roaring and the Indians gaping before us with their guns, spears, and hatchets to devour us. No sooner were we out of the house, but my brother-in-law, being before wounded in defending the house, in or near the throat, fell down dead, whereat the Indians scornfully shouted and hallowed, and were presently upon him, stripping off his clothes, the bullets flying thick. One went through my side, and the same, as would seem, through the bowels and hand of my dear child in my arms. One of my eldest sister's children, named William, had then his leg broken, which the Indians perceiving, they knocked him on his head. Thus we were butchered by those merciless heathen, standing amazed with the blood running down to our heels. As you can see, that last sentence is very powerful. Standing amazed with the blood running down to the heels. It is a solemn sight to see so many Christians lying in their blood, some here and some there, like a company of sheep torn by wolves, all of them stripped naked by a company of hellhounds, roaring, singing, ranting, and insulting, as if they would have torn our very hearts out, yet the Lord, by His almighty power, preserved a number of us from death. For there were 24 of us taken alive and carried captive. I had before this said that if the Indian should come, I should choose rather to be killed by them than taken alive. But when it came to the trial, my mind changed. Their glittering weapons so daunted my spirit that I chose rather to go along with those, as I may say, ravenous beasts, than that moment to end my days. And that I may the better declare what happened to me during that grievous captivity, I shall particularly speak of the several removes we had up and down the wilderness. As you can see, she finds a divine reason why she changed her mind from wanting to die in that situation to being too afraid to die, because it was now her mission to talk about that experience. The third remove. The morning being come, they prepared to go on their way. One of the Indians got up on a horse, and they set me up behind him, with my poor sick babe in my lap. A very wearisome and tedious day I had of it. What with my own wound and my child being so exceeding sick and in a lamentable condition with her wound, it may be easily judged what a poor feeble condition we were in, there being not the least crumb of refreshing that came within either of our mouth from Wednesday night to Saturday night, except only a little cold water. This day in the afternoon, about an hour by sun, we came to a place where they intended, viz., an Indian town called Wenemisset, northward of Quabog. As you can see, she's starting to use Indian terminology to refer to the Indians in this third remove, and you will see how that inclusion of Indian terminology makes her account more authentic, more reliable, and at the same time, more connected to the reality that she had to live. She is now part of her reality where she has to accept the Indians and understand them, including their towns. When we were come, oh, the number of pagans, now merciless enemies, that there came about me, that I may say as David, I had fainted unless I had believed. So she uses a direct quote of a psalm as a way of making her tone even more biblical and more engaging for her religious readers. About 2 hours in the night, my sweet babe, like a lamb, baby like a lamb, is very, very religious. The reference of lambs for the Judeo-Christian mythology is a typical example of innocence. The lamb resembles innocence and resembles Christian faith. My sweet babe, like a lamb, departed this life on February the 18th, 1675, it being about 6 years and 5 months old. It was 9 days from the first wounding in this miserable condition, without any refreshing of one nature or other, except a little cold water. I cannot but take notice how, at another time, I could not bear to be in the room where any dead person was. But now the case is changed. I must and could lie down by my dead babe, side by side, all the night after. I have thought since of the wonderful goodness of God to me in preserving me in the use of my reason and senses in that distressed time, that I did not use wicked and violent means to end my own miserable life. So there, she's dodging the idea of suicide, and she's accepting her role as a Puritan. It's interesting to notice how there's a paradox between how she refers in a very loving and endearing way with her about her babe, which she talks about only enough, only sufficiently. Not she doesn't even name the babe, and to make it more realistic and more appealing to the Puritan reader, she doesn't even refer to the babe as he or she. She refers to the baby as it. Okay, so she takes this stance that we already saw in William Bradford of trying to give a neutral, detached recall of the events as a way of keeping the biblical tone of the message. The fifth remove, because if you've ever read the Bible, it's never about someone's personal grief. It's always about the lesson learned and the purpose of why something is written. Nothing is written in the Bible as a segue to something else. Everything has a purpose to be there. So to talk excessively about the death of her babe was not adequate. So it's trimmed down to the bare minimum. With expressing her love and her thoughts, but only sufficiently for people to understand her feelings. The first week of my being among them, I hardly ate anything. This is a fifth remove. The second week, I found my stomach grow very faint for want of something, and yet it was very hard to get down their filthy trash. I think that concept is great. Filthy trash. It's like she still has a very clear sense of rejection towards her captors. But the third week, though I could think how formally my stomach would turn against this or that, and I could starve and die before I could eat such things, yet they were sweet and savory to my taste. And here I cannot but take notice of the strange providence of God in preserving the heathen. So God was working, the Indians were also placed there by God and were used as pawns to serve God's purpose. They were hundreds, old and young, some sick and some lame. Many had papooses on their at their backs. Papoose is a way that Indians refer to their babies. So again, she's using Indian words. The great number at this time with us were squaws. Again, another Indian word, 32, referring to Native American women. And they traveled with all they had, bag and baggage, and they got over the river aforesaid. And on Monday, they set their wigwams on fire. The wigwams are their tents.
and away they went. On that very day, there came the English army after them to the river, and saw the smoke of their wigwams, and yet this river put a stop to them. God did not give them courage or activity to go over after us. So he's directly calling the English army cowards, and for whatever reason they stayed, lacking faith, lacking activity, lacking courage, and preserved the heathen. And for all of this, she finds nothing but a religious reason. It's God's will to make all this happen. And God did not give them the courage or activity to go over after us. We were not ready for so great a mercy as victory and deliverance. If we had been, God would have found out a way for the English to have passed this river, as well as for the Indians with their squaws and children and all their luggage. Oh, that my people had hearkened to me, and Israel had walked in my ways. I should soon have subdued their enemies and turned my hands against their adversaries. So she calls a psalm, a quote from the psalm, to again ridicule the attitude of the English army. But in the ninth remove, I don't know if there's any questions in the forum. I think there aren't. But instead of going either to Albany or homeward, we must go 5 miles up the river and then go over it. Here we abode a while. Here lived a sorry Indian who spoke to me to make him a shirt. And as you can see, she enters in negotiation. So she's already interacting with the Indians, as if she was a member of their tribe. When I had done it, he would not pay me nothing, but he living by the riverside, where I often went to fetch water, I would often be putting of him in mind and calling for my pay. At last he told me if I would make another shirt for a papoose not yet born, he would give me a knife. Just imagine this. You have someone kidnapped. The person walks around at will in your town or in your village, and as a reward for sewing for you, you offer the person a weapon, which sounds outrageous for our standards of what an imprisonment or a kidnapping means. He would give me a knife, which he did when I had done it. I carried the knife in, and my master asked me to give it to him. And I was not a little glad that I had anything he would accept and be pleased with. So she's happy that his master, as she calls him, and she's already accepted her situation, is pleased to have a gift of hers. My son being now about a mile from me, I asked liberty to go and see him. And they let her go away. So they know that she knows that her son is 1 mile away. And they say, go see your son. She gets lost and she finds her way back. And nobody freaks out. I still find the narrative amazing from that point of view. It's too ridiculous to not be offended. The whole situation is just surreal. So let's read about it. They bade me go, and away I went, but quickly lost myself traveling over hills and through swamps, and could not find a way to him. And I cannot but admire at the wonderful power and goodness of God to me, in that, though I was gone from home, and met all sorts of Indians, and those I had no knowledge of, and there being no Christian soul near me, yet not one of them offered the least imaginable miscarriage to me. I turned homeward again and met with my master. He showed me the way to my son. So at the same time that she's acknowledging that she's protected by God, she's indirectly acknowledging that the Indians are not bad people. They have their mindset, which is different to the European mindset, and they have their own established social rules. But there is no wrongdoing to her for not being an Indian. There is no unnecessary harm carried out to her.
she says that it's the will of God, but the narrative clearly lets you understand that it's because all of the malevolence that is attributed to them at the beginning is probably just a misconstrued concept of from a European perspective. But I was fain to go and look after something to satisfy my hunger. And going among the wigwams, I went into one and there found a squaw who showed herself very kind to me. So here she's feeling very keen to interact with people and gave me a piece of bear. I put it into my pocket and came home, but could not find an opportunity to broil it for fear they would get it from me. And there it lay all that day and night in my stinking pocket. In the morning, I went to the same squaw who had a kettle of groundnuts boiling. I asked her to boil my piece of bear in her kettle, which she did, and gave me some groundnuts to eat with it. And I cannot but think how pleasant it was to me. I have sometimes seen bear baked very handsomely among the English, and some like it. But the thought that it was bear made me tremble. But now that was savory to me that one would think was enough to churn the stomach of a brute creature. You can see the huge evolution that she's gone through as a person and also as a narrator. One bitter cold day, I could find no room to sit down before the fire. I went out and could not tell what to do. But I went into another wigwam where they were also sitting round the fire. But the squaw laid a skin for me and bid me sit down and gave me some ground nuts and bade me come again and told me they would buy me if they were able, and yet they were strangers to me that I never saw before. So here she's acknowledging the kindness in the Indians, even though in her fabricated creation of a story, she's always going to attribute those elements to God's will or to whatever reason. But here, she's directly acknowledging the kindness of her captors. Not only her captors, but of all the tribe. The 20th remove is the last one, and it's the closing paragraph of the story. If trouble from smaller matters begin to arise in me, I have something at hand to check myself with and say, why am I troubled? It was but the other day that if I had had the world, I would have given it for my freedom, or to have been a servant to a Christian. I have learned how to look beyond present and smaller troubles and to be quieted under them. As Moses said, stand still and see the salvation of the Lord. Exodus 14:13. So she ends it in a very grandiloquent way, in a way that serves the purpose of being a truly Puritan story, with a sense of closure that says, no matter what the strife is, I always look back at that and say, how can I complain about my current life when I had to endure everything that happened to me during the previous pages? So I think it's a very good way of wrapping up today's class, to understand the evolution that Mary Rowlandson suffers as a narrator, and how the entire story serves the purpose of the Puritan plain style and the Puritan narrative, and also it becomes a bestseller of its own because of its distinct style and the intrinsic literary quality. All of those elements combine to make it both interesting, historically relevant, and from a literary standpoint, a worthy book to be studied in a course like this. We could find these chats in any file. I guess that's a question, and this question is by José Antonio Pérez. When you open I guess you're talking about the chats of the video conference. When you open the video conference, the chats are on the left of the screen, I think. They're disordered, so it's kind of hard to know where each comment was made. But if you want to read through the messages, anyway, I don't recall if anybody has said anything relevant in today's chat. That's where they are. I would really recommend you to do the same exercise that Veronica has done. Pick an exploratory question of your liking. For example, number 7 is about the 4 narrative modes that we talked about on page 74. Number 9 talks about the Puritan plain style. Number 8 talks about the first person narrator. Number 10 talks about those contradictory parts, the subtext, what we were talking about, what the text is saying and what the text wants to say. For example, in the passage when she talks about the English army, and how that has a certain subversive tone to it. It could be offensive to the people that tried to participate in her rescue. For example, number 12, do you have the feeling this works serve as redemption to affirm her faith in God? Why? Okay, so those type of questions, just to come to your own conclusion. Have we finished with Puritans? No, we haven't finished. The next Puritan that we're going to talk about, Jonathan Edwards, Unit 5, his nickname or the way that he's known is the last great Puritan or the first great romantic. So we're reaching a fringe moment when we're going to suddenly swerve to a different type of literature, a different type of reality, a different type of America. And now is when things start to get really interesting. So I hope you can come next week or connect next week. Thank you very much for those that have come to class. And thanks to everybody that's connected from home. Have a great week, okay? Thank you.